The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Silicon Valley Bank.
Hello and welcome to The Extraordinary Ordinary, the podcast from Women of the Year, which recognises and celebrates the achievements of remarkable women you've probably never heard of, but whose passion, dedication, hard work and fierce determination have changed society, lives and the world in all kinds of inspiring ways. In each episode, we'll be talking to an extraordinary woman about the experiences that led her to create the organisation, found the charity, launch the campaign, or raise the profile of an issue that she simply couldn't sit by and allow to go unnoticed or unserved. We'll discover what motivates and moves her, the challenges she's faced, the joys she's experienced, the plans she has, and the lessons she's learnt along the way. We'll also hear the sometimes surprising and funny answers to the four quickfire questions we ask each one of our extraordinary, ordinary women. I'm Jo Baring. I run an arts charity and I'm a writer, and I'm one of the presenters of this very special podcast. Later on, the other member of our gang, Leonie Mellinger, will be talking to one of the Women of the Year lunch guests who you most certainly will have heard of about what makes the event such a very special and inspiring experience.
Now for this week's guests. In the celebrity seat, we have none other than the hilarious Kathy Lett, and I can't wait to hear from her later. And this week's extraordinary, ordinary woman is someone who is quite literally transforming the experience of education for people in Uganda and Nepal, Katrin McMillan. It's so exciting to be speaking today to Katrin McMillan, who is the founder and CEO of something called Hello World. Thank you so much for your time, Katrin. It's wonderful that you are here with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
That is such a pleasure. Now, you've actually got a connection to Women of the Year, haven't you? And it's gone back a few years. And actually, your connection to Women of the Year was from a previous charity that you had set up called Projects for All. Are you able to tell us a little bit about Projects for All?
Yes, absolutely. Projects for All is the first charity that I founded, and Women of the Year generously supported one of the programs that we launched at Projects for All to support a human rights activist called Gift Augustine, whose work is to protect women and girls from breast ironing and female genital mutilation in Nigeria. This extraordinary, heroic woman, a nurse going door to door, educating mothers and fathers and grandmas and grandpas about the dangers of female genital mutilation and breast ironing. And at a time when I was really struggling to find support to just back Gift and give her time to do her work and a salary so that she didn't have to worry about making ends meet over here, so that she could get out there and do her community work there, Women of the Year stepped in and paid for her salary. And Gift has gone on to do the most extraordinary work across Nigeria, but she's since traveled to the United Kingdom and to America. She supports and trains other grassroots human rights activists. She's part of a charity that I'm on the board of called the Global Media Campaign to End FGM. And through that, she's increased her media training and her ability to speak to the press and speak on the radio, but also her ability to train and mentor other women and men who are working to end FGM in Nigeria and beyond. She's extraordinary. And before she had this kind of access, Women of the Year understood the value of allowing women within their communities who are extraordinary activists to keep doing that work, and supported her.
It's really interesting, actually, that you kind of just almost just slipped it in so humbly, but talking about Projects for All being another charity that you founded. So can we just go back to how you got involved in it and how you founded it, what you were doing at the time, whether you were in Nigeria, whether in the UK?
I started Projects for All. I was living in Nigeria. I'd moved from New York to Nigeria to work at a television network in a fairly ill-fated job. And that ended abruptly. And my boyfriend at the time, he's now my husband, was a diplomat and based in Abuja. And I was a bit lost, frustrated by the inequality all around me, not just in Nigeria, but more broadly. And in my spare time, when I wasn't working at various aid agencies, I responded to some of the problems I saw around me, because I was in an incredibly privileged position of not paying any rent and being able to try and respond to the problems that I could see. And after a while, various projects grew, and that work needed an umbrella. We needed to be able to raise more money. And when we moved to Ethiopia, I spent that year essentially putting the framework in for the charity so that we could raise money in the United Kingdom at first. And actually, Projects for All had multiple projects, mostly in Nigeria. We built the first African house out of recycled plastic bottles. There was the work to combat FGM and breast ironing. There was a relief campaign for victims of ethnic fighting in Jos, a soap company, and various other projects. The most ambitious project under Projects for All was Hello World, and eventually that became its own organisation. So they're twinned, but they've been separated out now.
Very much the overriding theme of it, or something that's really important for you, is something you touched on with GIFT, is that feeling of empowering the communities themselves to do the work.
Yeah, that's exactly it. My view from the beginning was that every community has the cultural capital to solve their own problems, and that international development's role is only to unlock that potential and to provide any tools that may be missing from that equation. I think that the most important thing is to allow a community to listen to communities' ideas and innovations, their cultural understanding, and to support their plans for their development. And too often, that just isn't how international development is practiced. And I hope that that's starting to change, but it's been changing too slowly. So that philosophy has always been there of community-led development.
So you've definitely been part of that change. But what's really fascinating about you, I think, is that then you were watching this TED talk by someone called Sugata Mitra. And for people who are listening who potentially haven't heard of him or haven't watched his TED talks, I'd highly recommend that you watch them. There's one called It's the Hole in the Wall, or Building a School in the Cloud. And it's all about education and how the education system is obsolete. And I was chatting to the producer before you came on, and we were saying that, you know, all of us watch these incredibly inspiring TED Talks. You know, they've had millions and millions of views. We watch them and we think, gosh, that's amazing. Isn't that incredible? So interesting. What can I do? And then you just go back to your own daily life. But can you tell us what you did after watching the TED Talk?
Well, look, I mean, it was the perfect moment to see this TED Talk. A friend sent me his TED Talk at a moment when I was totally fascinated by and frustrated by and preoccupied by the education deficit. Globally, pre-COVID, 258 million children, one in five children goes without access to education, which is, as we all know, their basic human right. And a great many more go to second-rate schools that are under-resourced with teachers who are unqualified. So this problem was preoccupying me because it feels like education is sunk capital. It's what we need to invest before an economy can develop and grow. Wherever I've worked in Africa, I came across school buildings that were derelict or had no books or no teachers or no students in them at all, built by well-intentioned, generous philanthropists who hadn't paid attention to the sustainability in the long term of this project. It bricks and mortar are very easy to fund.
You even talked about there was a nomadic tribe that someone had built a school building for them.
Yeah. I mean, we've all heard of these horror stories, and I've seen too many of them. I was visiting the Hama tribe on the Ethiopian border with Kenya, and they are nomadic, and they had a very permanent and very empty school building. And it was around that time that my frustration really peaked, and I was sent to Sugata Mitra's TED talk, How to Build a School in the Cloud. And I had a sense, I'm not very technically minded or savvy, and I had a sense that technology had a role to play in closing the education deficit. I wasn't quite sure what it was. I was starting to try and find out a little bit more and do some research. And he was 21 years ahead of me and had been leading the way into researching how far children can take their learning if you allow them to become autodidactic with access to the internet. And the results were remarkable. And I think back then I was more confident, perhaps I knew, because I didn't know what I didn't know. And so it seemed totally appropriate to call Sugata repeatedly until he actually answered. And he was really in demand.
How did you track him down?
Well, I think quite easy to work out, you know, email addresses and phone numbers. He was associated with I probably just called the switchboard at the university, I think. and then called and called. And, you know, he, to his great credit, he did take a call with me. And I just said, I need you to teach me everything that you know. And what I want to do is I want to combine what your research and what you know about how children can learn in the absence of schools and teachers, if they must, with my work in community-led development, because I think that we could turn your research into a functional, scalable development project. And so I've been trying to do that.
So for our listeners, if we just go back a tiny bit and just explain very briefly about what his philosophy is, which is it's self-organized learning, isn't it? So there are children who are homeless. You know, you said there are children living in sewers who aren't even part of communities. And what he had found in his research is that if you give them internet access and a kind of a community hub, children can teach themselves.
That's exactly it. You've put it perfectly. Children are desperate to learn. They're incredible autodidacts. And with access to the world's body of knowledge, not only do they absorb it and solve problems, work out how to fight for their rights, how to look after their bodies, become literate and numerate, but also solve really critical problems in their communities like sanitation and water and housing, but they also contribute to what we mistakenly call the World Wide Web and share their culture, their language, their art and ideas, and we can learn from them as well. So he set out to test how far a child could take their education using the internet. And the children just smashed his expectations, and they continue to smash mine day in, day out with their tenacity and their creativity and their incredible ability to self-teach. I think for those of us that went to a school or have children right now who go to kind of, you know, the post-industrial educational model, schools, teachers, all of that, we find it quite hard to imagine the drive and motivation that the children that I work for have and how determined they are to change their lives. And they know that education is the only way, and they'll stop at nothing to get it.
And there is a general feeling that that traditional approach to the education deficit just is not working. And so you then took that research and have translated it into on the ground community work.
That's right. So Hello World partners with communities and makes a joint investment. We ask the community, no matter how extreme the poverty is in that region, to make an investment in their Hello Hub. And they build their Hello Hub, regardless of how much engineering.
Tell us what the Hello Hub is.
Hello Hub is an outdoor solar-powered, internet-connected computer kiosk with 8 screens that are public, loaded with world-class educational software. It's a power station, it's Wi-Fi enabled, and it's open for everyone across the community to use for free. And what it means is that children and adults learn the engineering skills to build their Hello Hub and therefore to manage and maintain it. They've made an investment, so they've got skin in the game. The screens are very public, so everyone's using them together. But if you do happen to have a personal device, you can charge it at your Hello Hub and you can get Wi-Fi at the Hello Hub. And the results have, well, they've surprised all of us. The extraordinary innovation and the jobs that spring up as a consequence of the Hello Hub, the learning that happens, the advocacy, the radio stations, all of the things that are going on around Hello Hubs are always remarkable to see. That's when the real creativity begins.
It's so interesting, actually, thinking about, you said they've got to have skin in the game. So they've got to make the investment. It's got to be part of the community. They've got to have ownership of it. And again, and that's quite a change in the international aid paradigm, isn't it? And that's something that you're that's very important to you and the way that you work.
It's critical. It's the technology is just a tool, and it will fail after time, and it will constantly change year on year. It is just a tool. The real work and the real innovation is in working in a respectful way. It's pretty obvious, but, you know, for some inexplicable reason, when we think about working with communities in the global south, we have typically thought that the best course of action is to get the people who we regard to be extremely clever to solve problems that we have decided are the main problems, and then to foist our solutions onto unsuspecting communities who we expect to be extremely grateful and delighted, get a whole load of non-consensual photos. And it doesn't work. It's worse than useless, because you are undermining the fabric of that community. You are, by implication, saying you can't do this on your own. Your views, your ideas, they're not valued in this process. We know best. And I would argue that we really, really don't, and that they really do. So unless it's defined by and led by the community, it will fail.
And actually, that goes into, so thinking about recent movements, obviously the pandemic, but the Black Lives Matter movement as well, there's that sense that what you've been doing with Hello World and the Hello Hubs is that you can't tell people how to feel or what their ideas should be or how they should react to things.
I think it's an interesting point that you make, because for us, 2020 and the beginning of 2021 has been a very successful time in terms of our fundraising. For 9 years, I've been pitching Hello World, and more times than I can remember, laughed out of rooms, talked down to, told it will be stolen, told that communities will only use the internet to watch pornography. People in the West are obsessed with pornography, clearly, or that they'll only watch Beyonce videos, which I think is a perfectly reasonable thing to do when you've got internet access. But anyway, I've been told all of the reasons that this wouldn't work for so many years. And suddenly there was a bit of a shift last year. And I think there are two reasons for that, and you've identified them. One is that we were finally rudely woken up to the digital divide and its effect, and people started to finally talk about it. We're no longer regarding internet as a luxury, as I've been told so many times before. Even though it has already been recognized as a human right by the United Nations, people still talk to me as if it's a luxury. And also, many of us had home learners sitting around our kitchen tables using power, hardware, software, and the internet to learn. And we saw how much it was possible. We may not have enjoyed the process, but we did learn a lot from it. And I think that it woke a lot of the people that I talk to and pitch to up to the possibility of children to educate themselves. And I think that the other thing that happened as we try and keep the pressure on the conversation and the pace of the conversation around racial equality, we started to question more broadly and more consistently how international development plays a neo-colonial role and bolsters unhelpful or damaging and actively dangerous colonial mindsets. And I think what was helpful for Hello World during that time is that we have always been working to decolonize aid and to listen, respect, put the communities that we work for in the driver's seat, learn from them. And so we're not regarded as a risky charity to funders at the moment, because we don't send a whole load of people from here to other places to teach everyone what we know. It's you know, our teams are in Nepal and in Uganda, and the expertise is locally based.
Were you unusual in that respect then as a charity?
I don't think unique, but I think perhaps it hasn't been common enough. I do think that we sometimes default in the sector to incredibly unhelpful, old-fashioned, arrogant assumptions that we know more than people. I mean, we do that in the United Kingdom. I see it day in and day out. People who earn more than other people think that that's because they're cleverer than them or in some way better than them. And it's just that same mindset applied to nations, ultimately. When in fact, the myth of, you know, social mobility is almost non-existent in this country and most others. And if you're born rich, you tend to stay rich. And if you're born poor, you tend to stay poor. So why the rich think that they have worked terribly hard and done terribly well and it's all really deserving has always been a mystery to me. So I just think it's that same mindset in which we want to protect, that sense that we have what we deserve rather than just getting lucky.
Absolutely. Can we go back to, there was something that you mentioned within that, which I thought was really fascinating, actually, which said that when you were pitching Hello World to funders at the beginning, and for many years at the beginning, you were laughed out of rooms. So how did you deal with that? Obviously, you said, you know, you didn't know much about technology. You know, you'd had your experience of Projects for All, but really this was something new for you. How did you pick yourself up and deal with that?
It's been a fairly demoralizing process at times. And I think that perhaps one of the things that's been disappointing and fascinating to watch is that the power dynamics that play out when you are pitching, particularly for something that will never make anyone else wealthy. You know, there's no return, there's no financial return when you put money into a charity. And there is a particular ilk of person who really enjoys making you really beg for that donation and can talk to fit their version of what you should sound and look like and how you should ask. And I think that for too long, perhaps, I tolerated laughing at bad, you know, laughing endlessly at bad jokes and putting up with their low-level bigotry and nodding and smiling and not disagreeing as fervently as I wanted to. And I don't feel I have to do that anymore. And I just wish I'd got there a bit sooner. But no, I mean, sometimes I coped with it by laughing. Other times I came out of meetings and sat on benches and cried. And I made many plans to quit as well, then picked myself up and carried on. So I sort of wouldn't wish pitching a startup, a new charity to funders on anyone. And I hope that the way funders think about philanthropy will start to change. I really do, because quite often I've had to endure. I mean, I say all of this, actually what's been lovely is that we have grown alongside Hello World, a small but incredibly committed group of progressive funders. So perhaps one of the nice things about Hello World is that because we have always worked to decolonize aid, to put the community first, it's always been a plan ahead of its time. We actually naturally sorted the wheat from the chaff and found interesting, progressive, committed, cool funders. And I think maybe my failing was that they were people who I should never have asked or never have stuck around and asked again and got out of the conversation sooner, maybe.
We've talked previously in the past that no one asks men how they balance running this incredible charity and having a family and doing all this. But as we briefly touched on, thinking about the pandemic, there was not only the digital divide, but there was a lot of mental load that fell on women, particularly as Claire, our wonderful producer, pointed out before we started recording, that even the imagery that the government provided, do you remember that imagery where there is the woman cooking and cleaning and the man literally has had his feet up on the sofa? I mean, obviously that was removed quite quickly, but still it's a shocking indictment of where people think, you know, our roles are. How do you balance striving with this really ambitious charity and also having a life?
I don't know that I do balance it, and I definitely don't always totally cope. I think you're absolutely right. We don't ask men that question. But I think that if we ask the question, as you have done, in the right way of women, then it is worth continuing to have these conversations, because right now we're stuck in a bit of a silo in which we're told that not only is it possible to have it all, but we ought to. But society hasn't changed enough to make sure that that is really functionally possible. So until we have equal maternity and paternity pay, women's rights won't be protected in the workplace. Until we have more flexible working hours for both men and women, again, the same is true. So I have four children who are 8 and under, and Hello World is 9 years old. So and we've moved house and many times during that time, and moved country I think 4 times. I think there are two parts to it. I don't think that I could have be the parent I want to be and go and work for anyone else. So I had to build a really progressive organization that does offer equal maternity and paternity leave and pay, unlimited holiday, flexible, totally flexible working hours and locations, a culture in which we are trying to encourage each other not to demonstrate that you're working. Everyone's got these huge jobs, everyone's really underpaid, and I know that everyone is really capable. And so I don't want people to feel that they need to prove that they're working ever, because that sort of culture is really unhelpful for everyone. So I think that one way that I've made it work is by building an organization that could support what I wanted from my life as well, not just professionally, but also in terms of my family. The downside to that is that when you are running a startup and at times the only person at that startup, you never don't work. So you never take that potentially unlimited leave. There's no, for any, that for period, whole periods of time, there was no one to cover for me. My sense, and then when there were, my feeling of having to make sure that we didn't run out of money, you know, has been really pressing and pervasive and always on my mind. So I don't think I've got the balance totally right. And I think that it's a bit of a house of cards. So some days I feel like I'm absolutely winning and I've got it all sorted and it's fine. And I've had a birthday party for 30 children and I've managed to raise some money and work's going really, really well. And then one thing will topple this whole fragile setup, because, you know, it's the end of term on Friday. I have not done teachers' presents yet, for instance. And it can sort of take over your mental space in a way that's totally disabling, actually, to everything else that you have to achieve. I think what's tricky that I think that very often fathers don't experience is that sense that anything that goes wrong is because of the choices you've made. I went to a meeting about one of my children last week and was told that he was struggling a little bit emotionally with various things. And my immediate reaction was, well, this is because I work. This is because I work. That's the problem here. And yet the flip side is that I want to show my children that I work. I want them to be proud of me. It's definitely shaped my determination at work. I want my children to feel that I'm not saying the world is an unjust and complicated place with enormous and looming problems that we're going to leave for you to deal with. I want them to think that I was at least trying to help and to change things. So I feel guilty that I work. I feel proud that I work. But I don't think there are many fathers who would see that a child was struggling with something and think, well, this is my job. That's the reason for that. I think that one of the problems that we have societally is that we overpraise fathers who are doing school pickups, and they cook or whatever it is, and we act like this is supersonic, that this is extraordinary. Not only are they male, but they're also managing to do basic domestic and childcare tasks, and then we all sort of praise them. I was once sent a photo of my husband looking after all four of my children.
All four of his children.
Not quite. Exactly. And I remember thinking, I'm not quite sure what this photo is all. What?
Did you send back the clapping emoji?
Yes, he's more than capable of looking after all four of his children. How extraordinary. And I think that while men are still comparing themselves and their effort on the domestic front to each other, we've got a problem. They need to start comparing themselves to us and seeing whether or not it's equal in those terms. And when they're compared to mothers, then great. It's not that you're doing a good job of being a dad because you don't go to the pub like some of your mates on the way home from work. That's not it. Compare yourself to the mother who's in your family. I guess not your mother, but anyway.
Bring the mother-in-law in right at the end. No. And then thinking about the future, men have to be part of the conversation going forward, don't they?
Feminism is an issue that affects men and women, and women's rights, human rights, are not a zero-sum game. Until everyone is given their human rights, we all lose. The struggle for justice must continue for all of us. And actually, our patriarchal sexist societies the world over are bad for men too, I would argue, be struggling alongside women for justice and for feminism. And we certainly see, there are so many examples of that, but of course, you know, it's fathers and imams and pastors in northern Nigeria who have a huge influence on whether or not little girls are being genitally mutilated. And so including them in all of the conversations for girls' rights is critically important, and in so many other ways it applies across countries and continents.
Thank you so much, Katrin, for your time today. It's been incredible to speak to you. But before we sign off, we've got our four questions, which I sent to you quite late. So probably I've really caught you on the hop. So apologies for that. But the first one is, so we ask these questions to all of our wonderful, extraordinary, ordinary women. So the first question is, who is or are the women who have inspired you?
Oh, that's a tricky one. I mean, there's the dream dinner party that one day I want to host that's got, you know, Jacinda and Malala and Kathy Lett and Michelle Obama and Sandy Totsvig and Nadia Murad and Beyonce at. And actually even thinking about it makes me quite panicky.
Sounds amazing.
What would I cook? So I would obviously have to get my mum in to help with figuring out the menu. But so aside from that dream dinner party that's definitely going to happen, I think that it's more personal, really. And my mother made me feel that whatever I wanted to do was possible, despite my dyslexia. And she held that line. And she taught my brother and I feminism. And both of those things had a massive influence on my life. And my grandfather's best friend, Hazel Furness, was a Wren during the war and later a teacher for deaf children and an incredibly stoic, funny, brave, interesting woman, independent woman to this day. And I look up to Hazel enormously. And then, of course, like all of us, I couldn't do any of it without my girlfriends who see me clearly and let me tell the truth and tell me the truth and make me laugh. So some of them.
Oh, thank you. Okay, and what one piece of advice would you give your younger self?
Learn football. Yeah, just wish I could play football.
And what is the one thing you can't live without?
A list.
Love list, agreed. Okay, and the final thing is, what one thing about you would surprise people?
I think that I probably am actually quite shy. And I learnt extroversion as a way of compensating or circumnavigating the limiting aspect of my dyslexia. It felt like a really important tool to create a diversion ultimately. And I've been doing it ever since. But I think that people would probably be surprised to hear that I feel quite shy.
Thank you so much, Catherine. You have been such a pleasure to speak to.
Thank you so much, Jo.
Isn't it remarkable what Catherine is doing to change lives? Hello, I'm Leonie Mellinger. I run my own business as a communication skills advisor, and I'm an actor. Now, we couldn't get Catherine's full dinner party guest, but I'm absolutely delighted to welcome author and writer Kathy Lett, who recalled with her typical sharp-talking wit and humour about how she found the Women of the Year lunch very different from her expectations, and in particular in relation to the noise levels in the room.
Well, before I attended the Woman of the Year lunch, I was really worried that it was going to be too posh. You know, I thought it might be those women who plucked their high brows, and I was worried they'd look down their noses at me, you know, even women shorter than me. But of course, the opposite was true. What these lunches proved to me is my motto in life, which is that women are each other's human wonder bras, uplifting and supportive and making each other look bigger and better. But you're so right about the noise level, because don't forget, women use about 800 more words in our daily vocabulary than men do. We have what I call the black belt in tongue foo. And we talk so much at the Women of the Year lunch that our lips lose weight. And it's one of the things I love most about it is that loud cacophony of cackles that emanates from the room.
Do you think there's still a need for organisations like Women of the Year that celebrate women's achievements?
I mean, sadly, there still is a need for these celebrations of female achievement, because we still have a long way to go. And I actually think, you know, it's not going to change until men join us at the barricades. And it's not as though women are asking for a lot, you know, equal pay. That would be amazing. Thank you very much. We deserve it. We'd like men to talk to us occasionally, because I sometimes feel my small intestine communicates with me more often than my male partner. And we'd like them to, you know, do a little light housework, which is in their interest, because it's scientifically proven that no woman ever shot her husband while he was vacuuming. So, you know, they should just get to it. But I don't think that's asking a lot. And when we come together at the Women of the Year lunch, we don't have to just talk about serious subjects, which of course equal pay and feminism, very serious subjects, but we also know how to sugarcoat it in humour. And that's what I think will make the medicine go down better for the male population. We can be self-deprecating at the same time as we're being demanding. I think the great thing for our daughters is that they've had feminist mothers, and they've had the role models of us working and going to the barricades and refusing to tolerate sexism and sexist terms and misogyny. We've now got the Me Too movement. And now it doesn't mean that the Me Too movement has conquered the misogyny in the world. I mean, those top order predators are still there. They've kind of crawled under a rock. So we mustn't take our eye off the ball. But I think the tide is moving towards more female inclusivity and equality, but we still sadly have a long way to go. And as I said, it's not going to change until men join us at the barricades. One of the really big problems for women is that we face a second glass ceiling at home on the domestic sphere. And what really came out through the pandemic, because people were stuck at home doing homeschooling and all the domestic chores, is that burden was falling onto women. I mean, most men, like, giving a sweeping glance is the closest they come to housework. I used to have these arguments with my own husband where I'd say, you know, you've got to help me more around the house. And he'd be like, well, I'm a man, sorry, and I can't multitask, which we know is a cop-out.
Over the years that you've been, Kathy, have you seen changes take place, do you think?
I think over the years, the biggest change I've noticed is that it's become even more inclusive. I mean, it's now a female minestrone, not just celebrating women from all different walks of life, you know, astronauts and animal trainers and artists and police commissioners and poets and pop princesses and prime ministers, but also every different ethnicity, every different type of female. So it just makes you feel part of a huge global community.
Kathy, thank you so much.
Leonie, I can't wait to see it, the Woman of the Year, where we'll cackle like kookaburras over a cocktail or 10.
The Extraordinary Ordinary was brought to you by Women of the Year. To find out more about the organisation and its history, the lunch and the Women of the Year awards, go to www.womenoftheyear.co.uk or find us on Instagram and Twitter at Women of Year. For more information about Project Hello World, go to projecthelloworld.org or on Instagram at helloworld_org. Many thanks to our brilliant producer, Claire Lynch. Of course, to you for listening. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, please share these extraordinary, ordinary women with your family, friends, and the extraordinary, ordinary women in your life. The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Silicon Valley Bank. For nearly 40 years, Silicon Valley Bank has helped thousands of innovative businesses and their investors move bold ideas forward fast. With tailored financial services and expertise, Silicon Valley Bank helps address the unique needs of the innovation ecosystem across all business stages. Learn more at svb.com/UK. Silicon Valley Bank, built for what's next.